You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I had the wrong music. Okay, joining me are Tim. You know what? I figured out why I'm intimidated about Will's name. Okay, and it just dawned on me why the early N is in my head, right? As in Constantini. Okay, which is not his name. His name is Costantini. Okay, but his nickname at the basic school was Constant Weenie. Okay. Which, come on, how do you not like that, right? And the best part about that that nickname is that not only is it easily derived from his name, it's behaviorally appropriate for Will, okay? So the irony of both the linguistics of the name and its behavioral accuracy, right, I think is in my head. So when I throw that in there, which is intimidating me, and especially since Will's mom listens, I get nervous, and it stems from a long history of me screwing up somebody's name when they came on my program, and then really being nervous about it,
yeah,
or forgetting somebody's name in the middle of an interview and trying to get them to say their name. Right, right. Sitting there in the studio with somebody and not taking their business card, which I learned to do after this mistake, and like I can't remember their name, and like how do I get them to say their name? So anyway, and then what I wound up doing was okay. Look, tell everybody who you are again, right? Just so everybody knows. They look at me like, what? I already did that. I'm like, yeah, I forgot. Okay, so joining me from McAllen, Texas, Tim Lynch. Tim, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Mac.
All right. That's good. That's good to hear. And joining me from San Clemente, California is, or someplace thereabouts, is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how are you?
Good, Mac. Thanks.
You're welcome. And joining me is Will Costantini from upstate New York, but currently residing in the Kansas City, Kansas area. Will, how are you?
Great. Hey, I want to start you with a quote, though.
Yes.
We've been doing more with less for so long that pretty soon we'll be able to do anything with nothing.
There you go. That's what I was thinking about. Thank you very much.
Just here to help the host out.
I appreciate that. You know, it's easy to do it as the guy in the right in the second row, but when you're in the front row and you're trying to remember something that you can't really remember and all the pressure of being a multimedia star is on you, I mean, it doesn't always work out well. So.
Especially when you're so easily intimidated.
I know. Well, no, I don't know why. Look, I don't know why, but I honestly, it's a phobia for me. If I screw your name up, it impacts me. I don't know why. I don't know. It's just the way God made me. Okay. First of all, I know what Will did over the 4th of July. Tim, what'd you do over the 4th of July? You want anything exciting going on in your life, or did you just sweating it out in McAllen, Texas?
Sweating it out in McAllen, Texas. Absolutely nothing. Went out to dinner on the 4th of July, and that was about it.
Were there more fireworks where you live, or the same? Did you notice any difference because there was no big public events?
Yeah, it was more spread out, but it was similar to what you saw in L.A. Everybody started cranking off of their own, but the cops down here they're not down with anybody flaunting what they tell them to do. So they got very active, and we didn't have it very many nights. They don't tolerate a whole lot of nonsense down here in the valley.
Right. Jeff Kenny, Jeff, what'd you do for 4th of July?
I'll tell you, we pretty much just stayed around the house, but my neighborhood is. All the retired actors from the movie Idiocracy live around me. And so they set off fireworks in no particular order. It caused my dog to panic. And, you know, she's a Norwegian Elkhound, and we had to take her to the dog store and get her, like, a dog straitjacket. I don't know if you guys know what I mean. I think they call it a thunder jacket.
Yes.
So me and my wife are, like, basically – ministering to this shell-shocked dog. I'm thinking, how do these dogs work out in the trenches? Obviously, they didn't use Norwegian elk hounds for this, you know? But, yeah, it was an all-day thing. So I, you know, it was starting to annoy me, so I just started drinking like I usually do when things annoy me. So, or even when they don't annoy me, that's what I do. But so it was pretty good, kind of peaceful, other than the you know, the PTSD doggy.
Yeah, I dealt with the same thing, but we drugged my dog.
And we did that, too. We gave her Benadryl.
Benadryl, I don't know if I'd screwed it up or if he didn't really swallow it and spit it out or some shit. But I wasn't sure on the night of the 4th of July because in Orange County where I live, it sounded like Ramadi in 2004.
It was
unbelievable. So my dog loses his mind, and he sits there and he pants.
Right?
Dog, tongue hanging out, bad breath everywhere. And at first I feel sorry, but then after it goes on for a while, I'm like, get away from me, man. Look, we all have our issues. Get your ass away from me. So we gave him more Benadryl. And I didn't really – that was – I didn't think it would work. And then my dog got really calm, and he just laid down next to me. But I thought it was the Holy Spirit that came down upon my dog.
Maybe both.
That's what a good friend of mine said. And so he just laid down. And I was like, whoa, what happened? He got over his fear of fireworks. And then the same thing happened the following night. And I shoved another Benadryl down his throat, and he went to sleep. I said, maybe not the Holy Spirit. Maybe the Holy Spirit inspired me, and then I gave the Benadryl. So as Jeff said, it was both. Let's talk about a letter from West Point. Will, you have the floor.
Yeah. Hey, do you want to go back to yesterday at all or not?
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah. Please.
Yeah. I just, you know, yesterday me and Mac were talking about this idea of racism and how do you sort of work your way through it in a promotion system. And I was thinking about it afterwards. And there's actually only one place in the Marine Corps that is exclusively merit-based. And believe it or not, it's the Marine Corps Band. And why is it merit-based? The Marine Corps Band is like high-end professional musical organizations. And when you audition for the band, at least how it used to be, you audition behind a curtain. So that the people evaluating you get no view of your person. All they hear is your ability to execute with your instrument. And, you know, the Marine Corps Band plays right on the Commandant's front lawn a couple of times a week, at least in the non-COVID times. And if you look at the outward, you know, perspective of the Marine Corps Band, it's not what you would call diverse in the way the government views diversity. And I find that sort of interesting that we've got a great example right in front of us that we're concerned with excellence, and we're unconcerned with an outward appearance. I don't know if there's a way to translate that into the rest of the force, but, interesting.
That's a good point. That's a good point, Will, because the other part of that's merit-based are the it's similar to the band. It's like the Marine Corps boxing team, Marine Corps wrestling team. It's not. It's all about, you know, if you can achieve victory. These aren't you know, as important to the Marine Corps' mission as the Marine Band, believe it or not. But because it is, you know, a sport, and because victory is still the agreed upon aim, you know, then it is if you can't beat the other guy, you're not going to participate against the other services, you know?
Winning, the whole concept of winning. Yeah. No, and so, you know, it would be an interesting, you know, discussion. So is everybody here comfortable if we're not as good, but we're more reflective of the nation demographically? Or do you think in certain areas that excellence needs to be the standard and these things need to be blind? Because one of the things Will was talking about was, you know, the Commandant talking about unconscious bias in an interview with ABC's Martha Raddatz and saying that especially early in careers, we need to do more, right, to be aware of those biases. Well, hey, I got a solution for you, right? Don't put what gender they are, and don't put a picture of them.
Right, exactly.
Right, and it's just, and then you get, so will you be comfortable wherever that takes you? And I think the answer to that is no.
No, they won't.
No.
Because the whole thing's based on cowardice. You know, the whole thing's based on, okay, I see the way that the mass, you know, public opinion, it's not even the mass of the population, the mass of public opinion as reflected through the media is going.
Right.
So I need to appear to be on the right side of it. Right. It's so transparent and so nauseating. And that's where we're at now with all of this.
And if I could get in here, Mac, when you and Will were talking yesterday about the Raddatz interview, what I got from the Commandant, although it was mixed up, was a costless gesture that was part of performative race-based politics. Costless gesture. Yes, we're going to mouth the same thing. It was a distinctly different response than I remember when Commandant Monday got ambushed on 60 Minutes over black officers in the Marine Corps. Something which he was so upset about that he went toward the Marine Corps trying to explain himself, because I think they got him for saying they, as in African American, singling them out. And that to me was a Commandant getting ambushed. It sounded to me like Commandant Berger was pretty happy with what he had to say there. And it's, again, it's costless gestures, race performative of politics, and it's disgusting to see that done in the military.
But truth be told, right? That is a conscious bias in the military. Both gender and race is a conscious bias in the military on board. Yes.
How do you mean it? Race.
Well, I would say the fact that she brought up that 6% of the Marine Corps officers are African American is reflection not on the ability of the recruiting command to get after African American applicants. We did okay in my era as far as officers go. I had my OSO was Kevin Norton. I don't even know what the hell he was doing. He always made mission. But you couldn't fake your way through OCS. You could lower the standards all you want to, but OCS is a great leveler. And anybody that's gotten through OCS is not considered you cannot call him an affirmative action officer, because OCS sucks for everybody. And it's a great leveler. So I think that we do it right, and we're not defending our culture. Our culture as Americans, we're allowing people to basically catch us in Kafka traps, and I resent that too.
But what General Berger was trying to thread, the difficult needle that he's trying to thread is we want to be unbiased with these biases already in place. Yes.
If you're talking as institutional racism, I don't agree with that at all. I don't think that's a bias.
Well, no, but he says, look, we want to grow the number of women, right? We want to grow the number of we want to have a force that's demographically reflective of the nation. So with those biases, right? Then we want to be unbiased after that.
Oh, I thought we were supposed to be effective. I thought we're shrinking down to be more effective and more agile and more lethal.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you think the answer would be among general officers if you asked them this question? Do you think the Marine Corps should be blind, merit-based organization? Or do you think within these goals, diversity of the force, we should be as excellent as we can be within that constraint? What do you think most general officers would say to that question in public?
Well, you told them what to say, because they may not be able to fight, and usually they can't. But what they can do is they recognize the right answer of the you basically gave them a multiple choice question, and they're going to pick what they think is going to go over best if it was reported on the news.
So they're no different than the Iraqis and the Afghans that get captured.
No. No, they're not. They're all bad.
Yeah, back.
They're all
your premise.
I can't say all, you know, but
hold on.
You know, but it seems like the mass, particularly the ones you hear, you know, the Joint Chiefs folks and so forth, they know exactly what to say to get over. As a matter of fact, I mean, as soon as all this stuff started happening, demands about, institutional racism, I mean, it's a ridiculous concept, any institutional racism. But the whole point of it, yes, we have to admit this and then convince people we're concerned about it. But why do you have to admit it when it's not true? Because that's the trap we're in. We've been admitting things, we've been pretending things that aren't true are true for so long that now they're basically hoisted on their own petard. You know, I mean, you have to say the police need work because they're obviously racist. The truth is the police never been better. All the numbers are down. And the truth is the military's never been better. And if we lost wars because we had substandard people, or even incidents like the Rother incident, and I know a little bit about that guy who's basically responsible for the negligence that led to that kid's death. And I have to tell you, I got to argue a little bit with Tim about his OCS comment. And you know what I'm talking about, that guy. And so, you know, once you start pretending that things that aren't true are true and vice versa, you're on the road to disaster.
Will?
Yeah, I would say that general officers today would deny your premise. They would say, we can have this reflective force and be as good as ever.
Okay, and that's a politician's statement.
Reinforcing what Jeff just said.
Okay, so if I take you at your word, General, then you will sign up for my friend Will Costantini's solution, which is completely blind evaluations and promotions. Yes, because if what you just told me is true, and what would the answer to that, Will?
They would rely on their media training and throw dust in your eyes and talk about all the great Americans that we have.
Right. Okay. All right. Well done. Any other thoughts on that before we talk about West Point? We're going to kind of sort of come back to this issue when we talk about cancel culture, the educational system, and all of that here in a little bit. But any final comments about that before we talk about what's going on at West Point?
I'm ready for West Point, brother.
All right, then go ahead, Timmy. Your thoughts on first of all, a recent group of graduates of West Point penned a letter, and those officers are pretty formidable officers, right? So you're talking about a guy named David Binden. He's West Point's first captain. Will, can you tell me what the first captain is?
So West Point is organized into, two regiments, and then the senior cadet in the chain of command is known as the first captain. That's an official billet. At the Naval Academy, the equivalent would be the brigade commander.
Whoa. Okay.
So typically selected amongst really, really smart people because they overload them with administrative crap. So they got to be able to get through their schoolwork. So the first criteria is you got to be really smart. And then in theory, you're a leader recognized amongst your peers, although that may or may not be arguable.
So let me just go down the list because they're all formidable, achievers at West Point. All right. So David Blinden, first captain, valedictorian, Marshall Scholar, class of 19. Simone Askew, class of 18, first captain, Rhodes Scholar. Joy Schaefer, valedictorian for the class of 18, Marshall Scholar, Stamps Scholar, Brigade 1 Commander, Tony Smith, class of 19, class president, DEP, Brigade Commander, Men's Rugby Captain, Kerr Ken, class of 18, Brigade Respect Captain, Fulbright Scholar, Jack Lowe, class of 19, the exact same. Netang Monas, class of 18, Regimental Respect Captain, Schwartzman Scholar, Ashley Salgado, class of 19, Truman Scholar, Stamp Scholar, H1 First Sergeant, Maria Bloom, class of 18, Battalion Commander, Crew Team Captain. So, I mean, you're talking about, pretty formidable people there. So they penned and signed a policy proposal, anti-racist West Point. So with that said, Tim?
You know, back in 1932, General Benjamin Davis joined West Point. He excelled in everything in high school, and he faced what's called the Wall of Science. Silence, rather, which was the subject of a 1975 film. The Wall of Silence is where the cadets will not speak to you for the entire 4 years you are in the academy. And he graduated, went on to struggle in the rather racially segregated army until the Tuskegee Airmen. He's one of the original airmen, retired as a general in the Air Force. That was institutional racism, condoned and encouraged by the institution. When I hear these rather prominent cadets start talking about that somebody called them the N-word or that somebody did this or that with a monkey thing, based on what I know about racial hoaxes, I don't believe it. I don't believe it until you show me the 15 FBI agents that did that. They're engaging in a coffee-esque charade against the academy in which the academy's got to degrade and humiliate itself for crimes it did not commit. And the only way out of this trap is to either submit to this degradation of your founding stories and what you stand for, or face the onslaught from the social justice mob. And I know these people are accomplished, and I know that they've done well, and they're probably formidable individuals. But I fucking don't believe it. And I don't think we should be acquiescing to these kind of demands that are not made on specific charges, just anecdotal evidence. If you tell me West Point is inherently racist, I say, show me where the hell it is. And better yet, tell me exactly what we got to do to fix it. And telling me I've got to have white fragility classes is not an answer, because that's based on horse shit too. Our civilization is a little bit stronger than that, and I think I want to start that rant at another point, because I'm loaded up with another rant about the basis of this, our story as Americans. But I'm going to hold on.
Okay, what is institutional racism? What does that mean?
Well, to me, it would mean the silencing because of cadets are black, not allowing a cadet to go to the regimental officer's office call because he's black, not sending his officer club dues back to him because blacks aren't allowed in the officer's club and there's no reason to send dues. That's institutional racism. That was the United States Army in 1934.
But even then, that wasn't like written down and signed to. Like the Nazis, no Jewish person can become an officer in the German army post-Hitler after 1933. No one knew the horrors that were going to come. But the first thing they did is and it was in writing. And that's institutional racism. That is institutional racism. When you put as part of your laws, part of your institutional rules, that this or that race of people or this or that minority of people is forbidden from doing certain jobs or having certain titles, that is institutional racism. We don't have that.
Let me read a definition. Institutional racism is a form of racism that is embedded as normal practice within society or an organization.
There you go.
Whose definition is that? I don't trust anything anymore.
I think it's pretty vanilla, though. Right.
Yeah.
It's embedded.
It doesn't have to be written down. It could just be.
Well, no, and it doesn't say written down. It says embedded in the normal practice. So it could be verbal, as Timmy articulated, right? Or it could be a practice, but that it's condoned within a society or an organization, right?
I got one that was condoned. Do you know for a few years on that that place they made the T-shirts for OCS for the classes that was right next to the Marine shop? Hanging there in the very front was a 5th Platoon 1 Officer Basic Course 90 shirt that had a obviously African-American dude holding up a noose, a hangman's noose, and a number one with a bunch of other crowd around him. And on the bottom it said lynch mob. Now, that person that was portrayed was 1 Officer Walker, who crushed the O course record, and that's what that T-shirt was about. The lynch mob was a play on my last name. I had nothing to do with it. I liked it when they bought it, though, when they gave me one. I thought it was kind of cool. But that, if it were displayed today, would be considered racist, and it's not. It had nothing to do with it.
But you talk about the nuances. What we're talking about is embedded in normal practice within a society and an organization. Right. So what you just articulated was a notional episode that somebody will cite and say because of that, there's institutional racism, and it's not. It's anecdotal. And so,
yep.
So,
in 1990, perfectly well, nobody had any issues with it. Absolutely accepted in 1990, not even considered. Not even considered to
but
be
again,
slightly
Timmy,
racial.
But again, Timmy, I just want to draw the difference. It's notional. It's not. It wasn't embedded as a normal practice within the organization. No. You know, the whole T-shirt thing. All right, yeah, Jeff, your thoughts on your first thoughts on the West Point thing?
Well, that exactly. I think that all of their examples, you know, that West Point is a organization that's based in institutional racism are, like you said, anecdotal. And like Tim said, I don't believe it until you prove it to me, because too much is at stake now. I'm not going to take your word, you know, that you were maltreated when the commanding general there is black. So once you get into this, though, you can't even go there. You say, look, we're not talking about – it's not up to you to decide if West Point is institutionally racist or not. There's other, you know, functions within the Army that decide that. Your job, Lieutenant, you know, Schaefer or Lieutenant Binden, because they're both still second lieutenants probably, is to do your job where you're at. And we'll handle the rest of it. Just like it's not your job, mob person, to tear down a statue of Christopher Columbus. That's something that is going to be decided through referendum, through the voters and stuff, you know, how that thing is going to be done. None of this stuff we should never react or even acknowledge, you know, that there's an issue here until it's brought up the proper way that our government has laid out, the best government for doing that stuff that's ever existed.
Well,
yeah, I mean, several things on this. I think that there's actually things in there that could be actionable and useful. For example, this idea that as part of the punishment process, they go after cadets' pay. They never did that at the Naval Academy. We were subject to the UCMJ. But that was only used for, you know, major significant offenses. Typical conduct type of stuff that you did was handled on a separate thing, and they never went after your pay. The veneration of Robert E. Lee at that place is somewhat bizarre. But then, you know what? I find the Army to be somewhat bizarre in many ways. It's my favorite Army in the whole world, but it's still somewhat bizarre. And maybe that can be looked at. As an overall take on this thing, this could have been written by six graduates of Berkeley. You know, this is a communist manifesto type of thing. We demand. And with some of the things that may be useful in there, they spoil it, though, in their approach. They slander everyone at West. They say we need to unlearn racism. That means you are all racist.
Mm-hmm.
This is a thought control document. We want to control your thoughts. They do things like say, we need to bring on segregation, right? We need to have separate safe spaces where General Davis rolls over in his grave 17 times about this. And in the end, the document, it's about me, not about us.
Yeah.
It fits the Army expression, be all you can be. You talk about the distinguished pedigrees of the people that sign this. Well, you know what? They're about me. Look at me, what I did. I would go to criticize some of them directly. I have no idea if these incidents took place. But when the first captain of cadets talks about, I came back to my dorm room and there was this picture of me. You know, as a midshipman, the highest rank I ever achieved at the Naval Academy, I was so the brigade commander is a six striper. I was a two striper. I was I think it was deputy company commander I was company sub commander. So I was a midshipman lieutenant junior grade. Squad leaders would be midshipmen ensigns, one stripe. So I was one step above that. You know what? I never talked to the superintendent. I never talked to the commandant. I don't think I ever talked to my battalion officer, who was a Navy commander. The first captain of cadets probably talks to the superintendent every couple of weeks and probably talks to the commandant of midshipmen, who's either a full bird or maybe a one-star general, every day. And if when that stuff happened to you, you didn't have the fortitude to bring that to the commandant of cadets, who is responsible for the good order, morale, and discipline of the entire Corps, well, you missed your chance. And to go back now in time and say these bad things happened to me, it's hard for me to have a lot of sympathy for that. And I would say something too, that, you know, the Army is different than us. It just is. Can you imagine a second lieutenant or a first lieutenant referencing the rank that they achieved at the Naval Academy in any sort of public forum to other Marine officers? They would be laughed off the fantail of the ship. And you know what? They might actually get the silent treatment after that. After we were done ridiculing them. So this idea that you were a somebody at West Point, I don't care. Who are you now? How are you contributing to this unit? And I appreciate that they have these deep-seated feelings and they want to help reform West Point. If they actually wanted to do something, the tactics that they used in this letter are stupid, based on some of the language and accusations. The things that they want to bring on to absolutely control the minds and the thoughts. And then they just have – I don't know about the incidents, right? I don't know who said what to whom, et cetera. But I will say they throw one thing in there about the thing in Charlottesville, that they just continue the false narrative. They use the quote, they're very fine people on both sides. The president, when he was talking about that, was talking about people, what they thought about the statue. And I don't care what anyone says. It's a little bit amusing to me sometimes when you go through the South and you see some of these memorials and statues. But the idea that everyone who supports that is doing it in bad faith in an attempt to have this legacy of white supremacy is absolute crap. And so you buy into and continue a media narrative that when you read and see the full quote from the president, he absolutely condemns white supremacy in that incident. You poison the entire effort. And my prediction is that the Army is really going to take this thing seriously, unfortunately, because that's just how they are.
Yeah.
I would make two quick points. One, I think West Point has become a weak organization. And I think that was put on display for all of us a couple years ago when the cadet with his Che Guevara T-shirt paraded.
Right. Exactly.
Paraded all over West Point with evidently the knowledge of people at West Point. It has become, and then about a year ago, there was an absolutely scathing letter written by an instructor who had been a student there, and it was something like the long grade line is dead, or what's the honor code is dead, or something like that. And he just absolutely unloaded on West Point as becoming a liberal educational institution that also does some military things. It is not devoted to the military. Now, I know from my personal relationship with John Allen, going to give the decision-making class that I was doing at IOC at Annapolis, he was paying.
West Point.
What's that?
West Point, bro.
No, at Annapolis.
Okay, sorry.
Right. So so we're going to Annapolis, and his mood changed. And I said, I said, did I say something? he said, no, it bothers me to come back here because of what this place has become. And his argument was the same. It has become an institution devoted to liberal academics and not to developing leaders ready to lead the nation in combat. And so we had a discussion about that. So that would be the first point I'd make, is our service academies, right, West Point in the lead, are becoming institutions of liberal learning primarily, and then secondarily producing leaders for the military. And I think West Point has to answer the mail about that. If there's racism at West Point, then every fucking one of those leaders ought to be smoked, right? If you did not respond to these claims, right, then you have no business being a leader anywhere, right? And so to Tim's point, if this stuff happened and went unreported, then somebody's got to take a look into that. Why? Okay, why did it go unreported, right? And so West Point owes a hard look at itself to everybody, right? And it's got to be what it is supposed to be. And if it isn't that, it's got to get there. And the people responsible for that slide ought to get their shit fired yesterday. The second thing is in summary of action items, section one, an end to systemic racism, number three, right? Release individual statements from prominent white leaders at the academy, e.g., Dean Commandant, Brigade Tactical Officer, that's in parentheses, acknowledging how their white privilege sustains systems of racism, explaining the role they will play as an ally in destroying the norm of white supremacy, and mandating their subordinates to have these conversations in their units.
Yeah, I would say that may be actionable under the UCMJ. Yes. If I'm a full bird colonel and a lieutenant calls me a motherfucker without any evidence, that's actionable right there. And you just accused at least seven active duty officers. I'm considering six battalions are probably there. So those are six lieutenant colonels and the commandant of midshipmen of being racist. I would say Article 134, the general article, applies.
Well, since Will interrupted me, let me finish my little diatribe. Will, you need to control yourself, stud.
Listen, I'm a patient man.
You read that, and that is the narrative that a bunch of liberal writers, intellectuals just spoke out against. And it is fostered in academia across the country, and it's now being accepted as the truth. And if could you imagine if you singled out any other ethnic group and said this shit, right? I mean, people would go batshit hysterical. But this is now the narrative, and so which leads us to something we're going to get to here in a few minutes, which is how does this end if the universities are in on it? If this is what's going on in our elementary schools, that this is accepted as fact, right? And you have a portion of the media that this is their narrative now. I mean, what the hell? Anyway, but I don't want. Go ahead.
I think what happens is there's the pessimistic view that eventually there's shooting and killing and more rioting and stuff like that. Then there's the optimistic view that this is ridiculous. And it's like the last gasp of the Al Sharpton crew who needs this dynamic, fake dynamic of, you know, the put upon black minority from the white oppressors. That wasn't true back in the 70s and 80s when Sharpton started doing it. It's even less true now, and it's getting into the absurd. There's like millions of Americans, to include our former president, who are not just black, they're also part Caucasian. Or part other races. And so eventually it's going to be, okay, I'm paying reparations or some other ridiculous, you know, demand, but do I pay myself or how do we do this? Because, you know, the issue is fake. It is fake. And a lot of black people with you know, prominent voices are saying that. It's not just me. And eventually they're going to, it's going to be the emperor new clothes thing. It's going to be like, this is ridiculous. I think hopefully November, you know, I'm not like a prognosticator as far as election goes. I really was glad. And I thought President Trump was going to win, but I think it could be a landslide this time, or we could lose. I'm not saying, you know, I know what's going to happen, but my sense is that most of these, you know, Black Lives people aren't even Black. They're white, you know, white people who got college paid for, or they're going to owe money forever, but whatever. There's a lot of non-Black people in the Black Lives movement. And I think a lot of this, all these, you know, demands and all these accusations and stuff are just going to dry up like piss on a flat rock.
Let me just hop in here real quick. Marcellus Wiley, who's a retired NFL football player. He graduated from Princeton. He's from Southern California. I saw a thing that he did, and I kind of made him leader of the day on Tuesday or Wednesday. And what he said is this: look, man, we got to talk about the whole thing. He said, look, when I see 1% of Black men killed by cops and 90% killed by other Black people, what are we doing? Why are we afraid of this conversation, and why aren't we having it? So I'm not. He said, look, I'm just as afraid in the neighborhood that some of the neighborhoods I go into of what's going to happen to me in that neighborhood as I am relative to the police if I get pulled over. And he said, but we're not talking about that, and we need to. And it's this. And so I guess before we finish with the West Point thing, Timmy, is there something else you alluded to? You had other things you wanted to say about it.
No, I just wanted to go into the whole concept of what it is that we're avoiding here as a culture and the specificity. And I think I can wait until you think it's a good time to insert. Filibuster.
Will anything else about West Point? Let me just my last comment about the West Point thing is this. West Point needs to stand up and tell the truth, what they're dedicated to, what they've known of, you know, and they need to sit down and they need to address this. And to me, if they don't stand up for themselves and the way they run that school, I mean, and I don't, it's really discouraging. And to think that the first group that stands up is a bunch of liberal writers and intellectuals is, in my opinion, ought to be really embarrassing for a lot of people that call themselves leaders in the United States and around the world about this whole taking on this cancel culture thing, these false narratives, whether it's police shootings, whether it's institutional racism, right? It's anecdotal evidence, right? Episodic evidence. The fact that there are idiots out there that do stupid things is not institutional racism, okay? But nobody wants to stand up because they'll get their shit canceled. Who wants to do that? You want to be the next guy at Boeing? Nobody wants to do that. So to me, there's a bit of moral courage and leadership involved, and it is the single biggest problem in our country today. All other problems are subordinate to the lack of leaders across this country. They run scared. They're afraid to stand up for the truth, and they're afraid to stand up for the process that is this country. And there's no greater evidence of that than the budgets of police departments across the country that got canceled on the wave of mob activity. There was no task force. There was no deliberate, you know, meeting for months to say, okay, we believe that we can protect and serve the city better if we do these things with the police force and we massage the budget this way. There was none of that. It was a bunch of moral cowards who ran from a mob to curry political favor.
Right.
So with that said, Will, any final thoughts on the West Point thing?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, when you go to the service academy, you know, present company excluded, but you got to be a pretty high performer to get there. You got to do well academically in high school. 90% of the guys I was there, people I was there with, were varsity athletes, and all kinds of other things. So, sure, you're used to being, you know, you're a great person. You're a great person. You're a great person. And if I learned one thing at the Naval Academy, it's that, it's really not about you. And for me, that was a big growing up thing, in that, you know what? You're actually not all that special. Because when you look at around at 1,000 or 1,300 people that came in, there's a lot of all kinds of special people there. And I would say that it was a hard lesson for me sometimes, and a big part of me maturing as a person, to recognize that this really isn't about how well you do. And in the end, the organization there, somewhat of the administration, but a whole lot of your peers there, they actually didn't care how well you did. It's how much you contributed and what kind of a team member, teammate you really were. And I would suggest, based on this letter, that there's six people there that I'm not sure they ever really learned that at West Point. And if the service academies, I want to promote excellence. I want people that go there to be absolutely high caliber individuals. I want them to succeed and go to other, Rhodes Scholars and those kinds of things. That's excellence without a doubt. But if you never learned that the most important thing is, can you be relied upon, right? If I've got a platoon on my left and a platoon on my right, and Tim's on my left and Jeff is on my right, I can rely on them. If I got someone that's concerned about, did I get this, I'm not sure I can rely on them. And then the whole thing blows up in your face. And so if the service academy's got to do anything, it's reinforce or bring back that idea. It ain't about you, buddy. It's about us.
Absolutely.
All right. Let me just turn. So when I think of, when I think of these issues, the second issue I wanted to talk about was an article. I talked about it in the first hour, so I'm not going to beat it up. But it's an article, and the one I chose to talk about was written by the BBC, and it's a letter signed by many leading writers and activists that denounce cancel culture. Right. So to me, it's the first large group I've seen that has stood up and said, enough of this. OK. And so so what I want to talk about is, how does this end if the universities promote it, if our media promotes it? And we've already talked about how scary the lack of critical thinking is on a whole variety of issues that we've watched here in the last few months. And so if you're not capable of critical thinking and you take these narratives as the truth, how does this end? Where does this go? Timmy?
Well, it's pretty disturbing when you see a completely generic endorsement of free speech in and of itself immediately labeled as anti-progressive and anti-left. And some of those people are forcing themselves into retraction. It's the Kafka trap. Admit you're guilty of this undefined thing, and we're going to destroy you whether you admit it or not. I don't like it. And the problem is as Americans, we have diverse interests in this country now, who view each other as greater enemies than they do any foreign threat, because our culture has vanquished every common civilizational enemy. And other cultures no longer serve as an effective target or an outlet for people's sense of superiority. And humans generally require an adversary for purposes of self-identification. So now we got a new adversary, which is people in our own civilization. And this is a condition of leisure and empowerment. When there's no perception of an existential threat to our society, then we're free to go around and engage in the narcissism. This is a Freud term, the narcissism of small differences, and the urge to compete against each other's, even if it's a small distinction such as virtue signaling, buying the newest damn gadget, or whatever. It's you're motivating people to express a sense of superiority over the others. It's a dishonest conversation from the start. Because if you want to talk about slavery, let's extend the timeline back to when, because every civilization had slaves. That was ubiquitous. It's sort of like the climate change argument. If you extend the timeline back to the Ice Age, it ain't warming so much anymore. If you extend the slavery issue back into antiquity, we were all slaves at one time or another. No. But the narrative now is, no, this conversation starts in the year 1619. And it's arguing against the year 1776, our defining our national story. And when we, the people and the historians, rebuke the 1619 garbage, the elites turn around and award it the Pulitzer Prize. So you, it's again, it's a Kafka trap. You either agree with their bullshit, which is demonstrably wrong, not to mention the fact there were free Africans running around Florida for about 45 minutes, about 100 years prior to that. No, it's and this is the thing. And you ask how it ends. The only way it can end, there's only one way something like this can end. In my humble opinion, historically, we got to find somebody to go to war against it. That's how that generally ends. Or we're going to go to war against each other and continue to weaken our principle, our founding institutions. When you talk about all this nonsense the Commandant's talking about more females and gender couples and whatnot, you're introducing friction into the force. And they know they're introducing friction. They just think we're good enough to work through the friction when it's added to other people's friction when we go against an opposing will. That is not a valid argument. It's demonstrably false. And I am getting more and more depressed as this goes on longer and longer. There's a state senator in Minnesota, and Will will know this now that he's a power line reader, who's getting investigated by the National Medical Licensing Board for advocating openly on hydroxychloroquine as being an effective treatment for COVID-19. That's completely anti-scientific. It absolutely is effective. We know why, and this is the what you and you and Alex were talking about yesterday. This is a council culture on steroids. That man's got to pay about $20,000 in lawyer fees to defend himself, and he did nothing but say the truth. It's most disheartening to see that every major institution is against. The way I perceive things, I think the way we generally perceive things, and the way most Americans perceive things. This is we're the most non-racist people in the world. Like I said, go to Kinshasa, get on a plane, and watch what happens when the black executives get on a plane. The first thing they're going to do is check and make sure the pilot's white every fucking time. I mean, people have no idea what they're talking about when they say that we're unconsciously racist or unconsciously biased. It's a bullshit narrative, and I resent it bitterly.
So it's going to end, right? Because that's what we're talking about. This ends in either us going to war against somebody else and finding an external opponent.
Which is my way of saying it's not going to end, bro. It's not going to end well. The only way that you could get any kind of cohesion going, I mean, this is an old trick. Hey, let's go thump Mexico. They've done something bad. Only we're not going to buy that nowadays. No, I think that's the only way you're going to change the trajectory, because even if Trump wins in fall, it's not going to change the trajectory. It's just going to give us four more years of divergent observable reality from media narrative. It's just four more years of the same. So I don't know how it ends. But as long as I just remembered something, as long as I'm filibustering, well, I give a shout out to Simon Carrillo, whose son, Simon Carrillo Jr., shipped off for boot camp just last week, and they're a good-looking kid. So shout out to him, because I know he listens.
All right. Jeff?
I have a good friend of mine who was actually my first NCOIC in the Marine Corps. He was a corporal, and I was the last corporal. And he's very wealthy now. He lives in Texas. But he listens to this podcast pretty regularly, and he sends me emails to comment on it. He sent me one with an attachment last week that had basically, it's his letter to his clients. And in it, he puts a thing, a historical treatise on slavery, like Tim went over. I'll send it to you guys. But the guy made the point, he makes the point that, you know, it's not the way it's advertised. The history is not the way it's advertised. And especially, you know, in this especially chaotic time with the Black Lives Matter thing. And I have to tell you, you know, what Tim said, you know, has a lot of merit. But on the other hand, I'm thinking now, it doesn't matter. There's no more argument. There's no way you can convince anybody. No amount of facts you can accrue. No amount of, you know, positions you can put forth that will ever convince, you know, these folks. You almost lower yourself even going there. So I think what we need to do, what will happen, is we need to cling to the Constitution all the way up to this election. And ensure that this election, you know, as much as possible, is honestly prosecuted. And what that's going to lead to is, I think, you know, an improvement in life in the United States. I mean, that's the hope, because what will happen then is a lot of things that that are being, I mean, it's insane to me the lengths that that the left is going to get rid of this guy who's the president. I mean, if you see the things that they're saying now were things that they would never say 4 years ago, you know, under President Obama. And I mean, they're actually opposite. They're saying stuff. They're actually, you know, almost advocating for chaos. And it's obvious that they're unbalanced. And because of that unbalance, I think they're going to lose. Right now, you got their knee-jerk reaction is don't open schools in blue states because, you know, that's the teachers' unions there don't want to do that. Why would they? You get the same salary sitting at home doing nothing than having to deal with a bunch of screaming nine-year-olds. And, of course, they're saying it's, you know, because they're under at risk and everything. But I think a lot of people who either wouldn't vote at all will now go and vote, you know, for somebody who says, I'm going to put your kids back in school, because everybody knows instinctively that that's where they belong. And there's several issues like that that I think are out there and that will swing people over. And this could be, you know, the beginning of a change in the United States where, you know, we get back to, hey, I'm not going to have you fired because you think what you think, you know, you know, I'm gonna follow this thing, this Bill of Rights and this Constitution, and that's the way to the future. And I think more and more people are gonna see that. I bet you not as many people in 2016 know about what the Constitution says than in 2020. And that's what I think is gonna happen, hopefully.
Well, how does this end? How does this proceed?
Just to go a little bit backwards, you know, this letter about free speech, it's interesting. The Constitution only guarantees that the Congress makes no law. The government can't restrict your speech. In the private sector, speech can be restricted. And in parts of the public sector, speech can be restricted. Your speech as a active duty military person is restricted. And so this cancel culture that grew out of the left is now starting to eat the left, and you see the pushback against it. And this may just be the timeline of how things work, that everyone's for the cancel culture until it cancels them. You know, and just a historical note, Jeff knows the answer to this. You've heard of the Boston Massacre. Crispus Attucks gets killed. British soldiers massacre. It turns out to be, I think, six colonials at that time. And you know who defended the British?
John Adams.
John Adams. Mm-hmm. John Adams defended the British and I think got most of them off on almost all the charges. And I don't doubt that he took a certain amount of abuse. But isn't it interesting that in one of the very founding acts of the country, someone did what they thought was the right thing to do and didn't necessarily be concerned about with, you know, future political viability because of that. And so, how's the cancel culture going to end? It's either going to end because the left gets sick of eating its own, or because people have courage like John Adams, or it ain't going to end well. And I'm going to leave it to Jeff to be the ultimate optimist on the show today. I'm not quite sure I can go there, but that's how I think there's three ways it ends. Courage, it's in short supply.
Yes, it is.
Too many lefties get eaten up by it, and then they're going to find courage in their convictions, or it just doesn't end well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's been, you know, a radical shift in, you know, in our education system. And so this will play out in public and, you know, and I think if you, you know, research the history of mobs, like the mob is great till it comes for you. right? And I remember reading something that says, you know, I didn't protest when they did this, right? And because it wasn't really about me. And then I didn't go out and protect my neighbor when they came for him, and then they came for me. I can't remember. You probably
the Germans, the German thing,
right? Right, and it talks about how you get there, and then it comes for you, and I think it will in part eat itself, and then I have faith in the Constitution and our system, but what to me is so disturbing about all of this is that we don't seek the truth anymore, and we don't seek it in the media. And when somebody does, it's noteworthy almost. And I go back to, you know, Senator Cotton's op-ed. When I saw that published, the first thing I thought, I just saw the headline. And then I looked and I saw the New York Times published that. I'm like, holy shit, that's great. And then you watch the ensuing shitstorm. And you had staffers at the Washington Times say this: I feel less safe because we published this. That's exactly what somebody said verbatim about their boss who at a liberal website called Vox, who signed this, saying that, look, we're disturbed over the restrictions on free speech and the way cancel culture is attacking the expression of the free expression of ideas. There, one of the employees at Vox, VOX, said, "I fear for my safety now," which is an overt, blatant attempt to get somebody fired for standing up for free speech. And then the problem is compounded by weak fucking leaders. West Point is front and center now, a white hot spotlight. How are you going to respond? Are you going to get on your knees and apologize for your racist behavior? Or are you going to stand up and say, wait a minute, let me tell you about race at West Point. Let me tell you who we are. Let me tell you what we do. And every time it's brought to our attention, we respond to it in the way that we've articulated, the way we express to our cadets, and that in that which we believe, right? Which is, we don't tolerate this shit at this organization. And so when you have leaders that won't do that, and then when you don't seek the truth, you see this colossal shit sandwich, right? That is now being given to people who don't do critical thinking, right? And they're like, oh yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm really sorry. And the poster child for that is blazed into my mind is a white woman in New York City who got on her knees on the sidewalk when some black guy walked up to her and said, do you want to apologize for your white privilege right now? And he's filming her. And she gets down on her knees and he says, why aren't you saying anything? And she says, I'm trying to think of the right words. Like, and so to me, I don't know. I pray to God that at some point, you know, led by liberal writers and intellectuals, that the rest of leaders that have some semblance of a spinal column stand up and say, enough. Enough of this. You know, we all should be able to express ourselves. The guy at Boeing should get his job back. He participated in a debate, and that was the majority opinion. And now, 33 years later, he's forced to resign when he says, look, I've changed my opinion. You know, whatever, and whatever you believe about what he wrote, right? Every one of us is going to be hired and possibly fired for positions that we held, you know, at some point in our lives. If you don't call that a witch hunt, if you don't see the danger of McCarthyism in that, stuff that we recoil at, right, when we watch it. Except now we don't recoil because it's race based, right? And it's the white culture being called out, right? And so I have faith in the Constitution. I believe ultimately that the right thing gets done. But what you've seen across the country in terms of defunding the police is exactly what cannot happen. And so my own prediction is the way it ends is that it eats itself. And ultimately, you're going to see, I don't know whether it's going to be lawsuits or whatnot, where people get taken to task for it. The people that enable it, the people that spread it, are going to be held somehow or other financially liable for damages they do to somebody, and then that will put a hitch in everybody's giddy up.
Yep. And meanwhile, the next job of the mayor of Seattle is she's going to become the commandant of cadets at West Point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, in this country, people are going to vote with their feet. And
already happening. Yeah.
Yeah, they are, and one of the great dangers is that we all have to subsidize that. I don't care what you wackos in California do. I really don't. I just don't want to have to pay for it when all the tax base leaves California.
Right.
So that'll be a great, great fight.
Well, and let me tell you, that is going to happen because, you know, with everybody's inability to deduct your state income taxes from your adjusted gross income, right, that means that states like New York, New Jersey, California, Illinois, right, all states led by Democrats that have very, very high state taxes are going to see an exodus of high wage earners. States like California, extremely dependent on personal income taxes for funding, right, all the programs that they fund. Now,
ridiculous pensions for fucking.
Oh my God, it's a joke. But that is the alliance in California. It's the public pension group with the Democrats, and that's how the state gets run. And the way they keep the public pension people in line is they continue to raise their pensions to the point where at some point the state won't financially be able to do it. And it'll go in the shitter. But so my point is, what you're talking about, Will, is closer on the horizon than it has been in years because very, very wealthy people are going to leave those states because their state income taxes are too high.
And again, I don't care. That's why Texas and Florida are growing. New York, New Jersey are shrinking. But this COVID thing, you know, you see that's going to be trying to put in the back door in some of these bills is that the federal government covers state obligations.
Well, you know, and I know, the reason I don't understand that is the state has the ability to tax as well. Why is the federal government going to bail them out? To shift the blame so the federal government can say, we raised everybody's taxes instead of a state governor saying, yeah, well, because of all our programs, because of what we do with education, because of our pension, I've got to raise your taxes. Man, to me, you know, the governors, let them raise the taxes. Why is the federal government coming to bear you out?
Obviously, and that's why, you know, maintaining a majority in the national legislature is critical because these things are going to get jammed into must-pass bills. And before you know it, what you thought you were doing is extending unemployment to people who were adversely affected by COVID. And what you didn't realize is that you're spending $75 billion to bail out Illinois' upside-down bonds. That's how it's going to get done. And the only way is if there's some courage by people up the national level that say, we're not going to do that.
No, stop.
You lose control. You don't have control of the House.
Stop.
That appropriation starts, yeah.
Stop. Courage. Did you just say courage at national level, please?
I know, yeah. They've been able to fend off some of that stuff now because – you know, the Senate in the White House, but this election goes a little bit sideways, and all of a sudden, us poor taxpayers here in Johnson County, Kansas, are on the hook for your firefighters' pensions at $450,000 a year in California.
Right.
Let people vote with their feet. I don't want to live with all you wackos in California. Me and Tim will stay out here.
Wait a minute. You've been in, right, the Midwest for like 15 minutes. You're a New Yorker, okay? So just stop it.
And I moved.
Just stop it. Yeah.
You know, there's another thing going on that has to do with fighting back against some of this big city corruption and graft. And I've been noticing the FBI has been swooping down and targeting cities. They just apparently arrested one-third of the Toledo, Ohio city council, put them in jail for vote fraud and whatnot. They have pictures. They're all African American. You look at Baltimore when they tried to go there and clean up that place. The mayor herself was frauding the people out of hundreds of thousands of dollars with a bogus book. I mean, that's – and so how many more of these high-profile arrests do we get before FBI is targeting people?
Yeah, FBI.
We're not colorblind. We're not allowed to be colorblind. We're not allowed to do that. Right now, you've got professors saying that 2 + 2 = 4 is white European racist nonsense. And if I could get on my high horse, we can't celebrate. We can celebrate our heritage. I'm a Scots-Irish border, not all, but that's the part I choose because it's my last name. And then we've got an awesome heritage, as does every country settled by white Northern Europeans. The Hispanic culture is an entirely different animal, which I'm slogging through on a T.R. Fehrenbach book still. But we put the end to slavery, the only people that ever do so on moral grounds. We fought with each other in order to have a country in which we would not allow slavery. I mean, I'm not justifying it or anything, but we've got a proud heritage. And African Americans have been part of that heritage since the start. I know the most popular Western in the world, Lonesome Dove, is fiction, but it's based off of Charles Goodnight, the Goodnight Gooding, Goodnight, yeah, loving Goodnight Trail.
Loving Charles,
right, and there was a. It's absolutely true that character of Dietz was a guy. I'm doubting his name. Who was like a 6'3" former slave who was, Charles Gooding said, the most man he trusted the most all his life. He's the only guy that took gold to the bank in Denver because nobody would mess with him because he was this big black guy. They were 1 in 5 cowboys in Texas during the cattle drives were black. I mean, there's no reason for us not. Who's not proud of the Tuskegee Airmen? I mean, what about a motivational story? All this shit is part of our culture, but it's a white European culture that was founded on reason and science and a Reformation, and we can't celebrate that because now we're talking – now we're dog whistling. Now we're saying something racist, which is not anything about what I'm talking about. We're the third largest nation in the world, and we've got all these varied people kind of working together on this same vision. That vision is being torn asunder by the media, by racial agitators, and I don't see how it gets better. Minus a decent shooting one. Who knows? You know, you don't want to see those every once in a while.
All right. Final thoughts, boys. Will, final thought?
Yeah, I got nothing. I think we left it on the table today.
All right. Jeff, final thought?
Yeah, the only thing I say is, and this is kind of like going against what I said optimistically, is you look at South Africa now and Zimbabwe, formerly Rhodesia, it doesn't look good for when the if you're going to replace a system, you better have something of value to replace it with. Otherwise, it's a nightmare in both those places now for every race.
You know, I always believe it's a really great talk show when somebody starts by arguing one point and ends by arguing another.
Yeah, I hope we don't go that way because that's a possibility. I think though our tradition, since the late 18th century, is to stick with the good government we got.
All right, Timmy, final thought.
No, brother, I got my big message out. I just appreciate you having me on. And I super enjoyed the deconstruction yesterday with Will. Will, calm me down. Because when I heard that Martha Raddatz thing, and I spent an hour with Raddatz getting interviewed in Afghanistan. She didn't use anything I gave her. But when I heard that thing, I was screaming. I yelled, motherfucker, in the gym. And people were looking at me again, just like when you first had Jeff on. And I would start laughing hysterically and fall off the goddamn running machine. But that was a quality segment, and I really enjoyed it.
Will is a master deconstructor of the obvious.
Yeah. He's got a better perspective, man, and he's calm. Because if you had played that tape and said, Timmy, what do you think? I don't think I would have thought anything coherent. I was so pissed.
Right.
Hey, Mac, I've had a lot of practice, you know, deconstructing obvious things for my close friends.
Well, tell him I said hi when you talked to him. The truth is important, right? We still haven't got to that on the behavior of police. And so to me, if you don't start from the truth, and you don't stand up for freedom of speech, right? And then I don't know where you go with all this, and it's pretty disturbing. And so we'll see. All right, boys. Thank you very much for doing this, and have a good week. I'll talk to you next week from Montana.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. All right. Nice. Big sky.
Big sky. Big sky country. All right.
Big sky,
see
a little bullet.
There you go. See you later.
See ya.
All right. The truth, man. Not easy. But you're looking at organizations like West Point. If West Point won't stand up and tell the truth, like, are you kidding me? Yeah. Right. Do you remember a video that was done by the commandant of the Air Force Academy? I don't know, the superintendent of the Air Force Academy, when I think it was the N-word was written on the dry erase board at the Air Force Academy prep school for, it was written on the dry erase board of one or two black, I don't think they're cadets down there, but whatever they call those students down there at their prep school. Maybe they call them cadets, I don't fucking know. But anyway, he stood up, his name is Silveria. And he got everybody that's on the staff of the Air Force Academy, and in a very public way, I'm trying to see if I can find it. Okay, I'm going to play it for you right now. So let me kill Steve Winwood right there. And this is him. This is just a piece of it.
If but you shop on-
it was a powerful it was a powerful thing that he said. Okay? And so this is an excerpt.
You may have heard
from the CBS Morning News.
Wrote some racial slurs on some message boards.
This is him.
This week, Lieutenant General Jay Silveria had some fighting words for thousands of cadets, faculty, and senior officers at the Air Force Academy in Colorado.
If you're outraged by those words, then you're in the right place.
Those words had been discovered by five black students outside their rooms.
And on a dry erase board, it said... It said, go home, and then the N-word.
You should be outraged not only as an airman, but as a human being.
The Air Force Academy posted the remarks to YouTube on Thursday. So far, they've been viewed more than 500,000 times.
We would also be tone deaf not to think about the backdrop of what's going on in our country. Things like Charlottesville and Ferguson, the protests in the NFL. That's why we have a better idea.
The idea, he said, is the power of diversity.
The power that we come from all walks of life, that we come from all parts of this country, that we come from all races, we come from all backgrounds, gender, all makeup, all upbringing, and makes us that much more powerful.
The Air Force superintendent even asked cadets to record part of the message on their cell phones to make sure it isn't forgotten.
If you can't teach someone from another gender, whether that's a man or a woman, with dignity and respect, then you need to get out. And if you can't treat someone from another race or a different color skin with dignity and respect, then you need to get out.
This has resonated.
Ladies and gentlemen.
All right, I want to play for you the whole thing, okay? And I want to tell you in advance of playing the whole thing this. That one of those five black students wrote that on that dry erase board. Nobody from the academy did. Okay? Nobody from the academy did. And so, you know, when you hear cadets of that stature at West Point make accusations, why didn't you report it and why didn't you allow the institution to take action against it? So the and Lieutenant General, I think his first name is Jay. Yeah, Jay Silveria. Silveria. And so this is the whole thing that he said, right?
You may have heard that some people down in the prep school wrote some racial slurs on some message boards. If you haven't heard that, I wanted you to hear it from me. If you're outraged by those words, then you're in the right place. That kind of behavior has no place at the prep school. It has no place at USAFA, and it has no place in the United States Air Force. You should be outraged not only as an airman, but as a human being. And I'll tell you that the appropriate response for horrible language and horrible ideas, the appropriate response is a better idea. So that's why I'm here. That's why all these people are up here on the staff tower. So let me have everybody who's up here, please pull forward to the rails. Also, there are so many people here, they're lining the outsides along the windows.
So he got everybody there, right? Everybody's ass is going to be here. Okay? That's how pissed he is. Okay? When he found out.
These are members of the faculty.
This is the institutional response to the accusation, which was false.
Team. Coaching staff, AOCs, AMTs, from the airfield, from my staff, from my headquarters. All aspects of the 10th Air Base Wing, all aspects that make up USAFA and the United States Air Force Academy. Leadership is here. You heard from Brigadier General Goodwin. Brigadier General Armacost is here. Colonel Block from the Athletic Department is here. Mr. Knowlton is in Washington, D.C. right now. That's why they're here. That's why we're all here, because we have a better idea. Some of you may think that that happened down in the prep school and doesn't apply to us. I would be naive, and we would all be naive to think that everything is perfect here. We would be naive to think that we shouldn't discuss this topic. We would also be tone deaf not to think about the backdrop of what's going on in our country. Things like Charlottesville and Ferguson, the protests in the NFL. That's why we have a better idea. One of those ideas, the dean brought people together to discuss Charlottesville. Because what we should have is a civil discourse and talk about these issues. That's a better idea. We received outstanding feedback from that session at Charlottesville. But I also have a better idea, and it's about our diversity. And it's the power of the diversity, the power of the 4,000 of you and all of the people that are on the staff tower and lining the glass, the power of us as a diverse group, the power that we come from all walks of life, that we come from all parts of this country, that we come from all races, we come from all backgrounds, gender, all makeup, all upbringing. The power of that diversity comes together and makes us that much more powerful. That's a much better idea than small thinking and horrible ideas. We have an opportunity here, 5,500 people in this room, to think about what we are as an institution. This is our institution, and no one can take away our values. No one can write on a board and question our values. No one can take that away from us. So just in case you're unclear on where I stand on this topic, I'm going to leave you with my most important thought today. If you can't treat someone with dignity and respect, then you need to get out. If you can't teach someone from another gender, whether that's a man or a woman, with dignity and respect, then you need to get out. If you demean someone in any way, then you need to get out. And if you can't treat someone from another race or a different color skin with dignity and respect, then you need to get out. Reach for your phones. I'm serious. Reach for your phones. Okay, you don't have to reach for your phones. I'm going to give you an opportunity to reach for your phones. Grab your phones. I want you to videotape this so that you have it, so that you can use it. So that we all have the moral courage together. All of us on the staff tower, lining the glass, all of us in this room. This is our institution. And if you need it, and you need my words, then you keep these words. And you use them, and you remember them, and you share them, and you talk about them. If you can't treat someone with dignity and respect, then get out.
Where is the guy at West Point or the woman at West Point that's going to give that speech? Right? Treating the institution, each other with dignity and respect. Right? Whether you're part of the majority or you're part of the minority. That's the way this country is supposed to be. Right? Not canceling people because we don't like what you say. Where is that person at West Point that's going to stand up? That these things happened on our watch and they weren't brought to our attention so we could take action here? What's going on here? The fact that they happen, right? Is that a surprise to anybody? No. There's idiots among us. Right? That's why we have institutions that have rules. What's going on where people won't come forward with it? He talks about terrible ideas, right? Mobs, destroying careers and lives, and a lack of moral courage. Those are horrible ideas, right? Great ideas are the truth, articulate discourse, respect, right? And evolving this imperfect experiment in democracy to something greater, because there is no greater one on the planet. But that stuff seems, the good ideas seem to be in short supply these days. So when you have all of us, when you have an opportunity to stand up and make a difference, don't be afraid. Whether it's to sign an online petition, whether it's to sit down and talk to your kids about it, whether it's in some other form to be able to stand up for what has made this country great. Right? What has made this country great. Then you need to stand up. You need to stand up. And again, just a footnote on that. Nobody, right, connected with the Air Force Academy or the Air Force Academy Prep School wrote those words. Those words were written by one of the cadets. One of those cadets, one of the five black cadets. They were written by that person. Okay? So, but you see, the reason me playing that is you see the response of somebody who's dedicated their entire life to treating people fairly, to a merit-based organization that looks out for everybody, which is what we swear an oath to do. And I think his anger, I think it is appropriate. So I wanted to play that. When you get a chance, don't be afraid to get angry. Don't be afraid to stand up for the better idea. And the better idea is this experiment in democracy. It is imperfect. It is evolving. Don't be afraid to stand up for truth, for dignity, and respect and articulate discourse. And normally, if you'll stand up for those things, what comes out of those things is pretty good. That is lacking in our country today. And I'll close the story kind of the way I opened it. And that is the irony of liberal scholars and writers, you know, standing up and signing a document. And I saw some names on it that might surprise you. I'll start from the bottom. Fareed Zakaria is a CNN person. Now, sometimes I would imagine they decided how they would be depicted, right? He has nothing after his name. He doesn't have CNN journalist, right? Gary Wills is a writer. whose name I recognize. I'm just looking for people whose names. Gloria Steinem, you know, feminist, right? Salman Rushdie, J.K. Rowling. Olivia Nuzzi, New York Magazine. Wynton Marsalis, jazz artist. David Brooks, columnist, who writes, I believe, at the New York Times. I wonder if that made somebody nervous for their safety at the New York Times, that he would have the unmitigated gall to sign something like this. Dexter Filkins, another writer. Malcolm Gladwell, who's one of, you know, whose stuff I enjoy all the time. Let's see, let me give you one more. Garry Kasparov, the grandmaster chess, you know, person. So, I mean, you can see, I'm pretty prominent people, but most disturbing is the limited number of them, 150. I don't know how they got tapped, how they got contacted to see if they'd like to be a part of this. But, I mean, that list should be a lot broader. Anyway, on this Thursday, have a great day. More of All Marine Radio coming up tomorrow. Then head up to Montana where do a week's worth of post-traumatic winning at veteran retreats that are going on up there with an organization called Bar X. And I'm really looking forward to it. A good friend of mine, Montana Man, will be up there. I think F-18 Man is coming and bringing one of his sons. And so get to see those guys up there in addition to doing some work. And so it'll be an awesome week and looking forward to sitting and talking about, you know, life after trauma enters it and how we can be agents of change. And again, trying to live what I preach, but, you know, focus on the truth, listen to people. And if you do that, normally you'll go to a good place. And that's the genesis of post-traumatic winning, is listening to all the interviews and then now sharing that, and then challenging people with the truth, and then challenging them to go change other people's lives, and pretty cool what comes out of it. So looking forward to doing that. So on that note, we will be back tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel. So on a Thursday, All Marine Radio, over and out.